The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. I'm here with pharmacist Scott Gavura. Scott has a professional interest in improving the cost-effective use of drugs and helping consumers make more informed decisions about their health. He blogs about pharmacy practice and questionable science at Science-Based Pharmacy and Science-Based Medicine. Welcome back, Scott.
Hi, Desiree.
So today we're talking about the common cold, and let's just start out with what it is, because not everybody knows.
So a cold is a viral infection of your upper respiratory tract, and there's more than 200 different viruses can cause the cold. So the most common one is called the rhinovirus, which is about 30 to 50% of those colds. But there's a number of other different types of viruses that can cause colds. And that's why the colds can be so variable in, you know, kind of the symptoms that you have and how long they last.
Well, why does it make you feel so awful?
So these viruses, they colonize your respiratory tract. So mainly the back of the throat. And then they cause this kind of release of all these different cell signals, chemicals like histamine, leukotrienes. And that's what causes the initial symptoms. And then your body mounts an immune response, and that causes the other symptoms as well that you're having, which is the sore, scratchy throat. That's often what you notice first. You know, you're sneezing, your nasal discharge, the stuffiness. Sometimes you can get ear infections and sinus infections after as a consequence of having the cold. So that's kind of what it is. Basically, your body's fighting off an infection in the back of your throat, in your upper respiratory tract. And it's that battle which is causing all the symptoms, which make you pretty snotty.
Well put. Well, how is that different from the flu?
Influenza, or the flu, is a lot more serious. And it's much more serious, but it's much less common. So the flu is caused by three different types of viruses, you know, conveniently named influenza A, B, and C. And influenza A is the virus that's responsible for the pandemics and the flu outbreaks that spread worldwide. So influenza A can cause fairly severe disease, and it can cause deaths even in young people. So if you remember H1N1, I think I actually was on the show talking about this. Mm-hmm. That was a strain of influenza A. So influenza is, you know, most people recover, but it can cause complications which can lead to hospitalizations and, you know, and to deaths as well. So you can think of flu as kind of being a much more severe, although much more rare, type of infection in most cases. The other difference as well is that cold-causing rhinoviruses don't usually cause severe damage to the actual tissues, but the flu or, you know, the influenza viruses can actually cause extensive damage to the respiratory tract and to the epithelium, so the outer surface of the tissue as well. So while there's similarities, influenza can really be a lot more deadly than a cold.
And how is it spread, a cold?
So there's two different ways. The first is direct contact with secretions. I can picture that. So secretions that contain the virus, so either directly from an infected person or kind of indirectly with the telephone, the doorknob, or for those of you who take public transit, any surface on public transit. You know, subsequently, you touch a surface that has the virus on it. You either touch your nose or your eye, and that can lead to the infection, or it can be inhaled directly. You inhale the virus when someone sneezes. If you look on YouTube, you can see these slow motion videos of people sneezing, and you can see just how far those, you know, the aerosols are being sprayed. So you can inhale an aerosolized virus, and it can enter your respiratory tract, and it starts colonizing.
So why exactly is a cold so hard to get rid of?
Your body's immune system really has to fight that infection. So the colds can be variable in terms of, because there's so many different types of viruses. So some infections will be short-lived and some will last quite a long time. And it's this variation that can give the impression that different types of treatments are effective. And I think we can come back to that. But certainly the fact that your cold can be highly variable in how long it lasts can have an impact in terms of your evaluation of whatever you did, whether it made the cold get better or not.
Now, something that I always hear around cold and flu season is that you're contagious before you show any cold symptoms. Is that true?
I think that's probably true, but the time frame would vary. You can get sick several hours after getting exposed, but it can also take a day or two. And it really depends on whether you had a huge exposure or a small exposure in terms of how many viruses you were exposed to. And the type of cold virus will influence the symptoms. So if you have a less aggressive virus and a less severe cold, you might not notice it for a longer period. But once you're infected, that virus starts replicating itself. So say half a day or so. So it's those first few days are when you're most contagious because your immune response really hasn't kicked in yet. After a few days of having the cold, you're less contagious. But you should probably assume that as long as you have symptoms, you're probably capable of spreading the virus.
What's the best way to avoid getting a cold?
It's simple, but it's pretty much impossible. Probably the first is to make a habit of keeping your hands clean. So washing your hands is always is preferable, and use alcohol gels when necessary. You know, if you're around someone sick, you could wear a mask. That could conceivably help, but who's going to do that? Everyone kind of looks kind of oddly at those people wearing masks on the subway or on the bus. I know I do, and I stay far away from them, but maybe that's helping me stay healthy. But, you know, because of that incubation period we talked about, you're likely encountering people who are probably shedding the virus without any serious symptoms. So looking for symptoms and then taking action is probably only a partial solution. So your best approach is, I'd say, really to focus on hand hygiene, particularly during the flu seasons.
Now, what are some myths about catching a cold?
Well, some of the common ones is, you know, you get cold or you get wet, and they say you're going to get a cold because you're wet. You know, some people believe that becoming chilled or wet can cause a cold or a flu. But, you know, it's a viral infection, so unless you're so cold, your immune system is affected, which is unlikely, then probably no. You know, the effect of stress on the immune system itself is controversial. So there's some evidence to suggest that stress might increase the risk of catching a cold, but I'd say it's far from clear. What's interesting to note is when exposed to a cold virus under experimental conditions, so if someone sprays the virus up into your nostril, almost 100% of people become infected. So
really?
Once the virus gets into your nose, yeah, you're pretty much going to get infected.
Well, that's depressing. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to pharmacist Scott Gavura about the common cold. So we're probably all going to get a cold, is what you're saying. So how do we deal with it once we have it? Because there are an awful lot of products on the shelf, and there are also a lot of alternative remedies that claim to be effective. So where do we start?
If you walked into your pharmacy and you looked on the shelves, you're going to see dozens and dozens of products. I went into a pharmacy and I picked up a list of like 20 things that I saw that it was suggested that I buy for flu season. So I don't want to name the pharmacy because I don't want to pick on one in particular. Most pharmacies provide lists like this. And I guess in general, when you look at studies, we can talk about the specifics of products. When we look at studies of cold treatments, in a lot of cases, there's usually a subjective placebo response. And that is, people given placebos will generally report milder symptoms, although whether they're actually objectively better is difficult to say. And in general, you know, medications and treatments are kind of at best partially effective, and we can get into the specifics of those. The benefits with most cold medications are not so dramatic that it's clearly effective. So maybe we can start. Let's separate the products. And I don't think it's fair really to separate them into alternative or not. Let's just look at what works. So why don't we start with kind of going through the treatment of colds. Let's assume you've got one or you're going to get one. So we can talk about treatment first, and then we can talk about prevention after.
Lovely. Treatments. Go.
Okay. So we can start with what's effective. So we can say that, you know, the anti-inflammatory drugs, so these are like the Advils and the Motrins, those are effective. They're effective for the pain and some of the symptom relief, and they actually have some effectiveness at actually reducing cough as well. So I would put the anti-inflammatory drugs into the category of being probably or demonstrated to be effective for cold symptoms. So I usually suggest those for people who are having those types of symptoms, whether it's headache or anything else, and anti-inflammatories are generally something that I would recommend as long as you can take them. I guess the other products would be the antihistamines. And this might surprise you because a lot of people take antihistamines for seasonal allergies. Mm-hmm. But as I said, when the cold virus starts infecting you, histamine is released as part of the infection process. So antihistamines, these are the old ones, so these would be the ones that can cause some drowsiness, like clortriptyline. They can actually help reduce sneezing, runny nose, and possibly some cough as well, but they can cause drowsiness as well. But in general, you know, taking an anti-inflammatory and maybe an antihistamine is probably a reasonable option for symptom relief. And I guess it's a good time to point out that there's really no good evidence to show that any of the treatments are actually going to reduce the duration of your cold. So, you know, you can do nothing and your cold will last for 7 days, or you can treat it like crazy and it'll last for a week. It's not really going to make a lot of difference in terms of how long you have the cold. But, you know, things like anti-inflammatory drugs and antihistamines can provide some, there are reasonable options for kind of symptom relief. The next category would be the decongestants. So these are the products used to be called Sudafed. You used to see it on the shelf, but you don't see them as much anymore because it was being redirected into making illegal drugs. So they're a little hard. It's a little harder to find now.
Right.
But the decongestants, even ones like the Sudafed, they can have a modest effect. If you see a product that contains a decongestant like phenylephrine, that's not good evidence to show that it does anything. Or you can see those nasal sprays like Otrivin or Dristan. And they do work for short periods, but they really aren't useful for more than a few days because if you use them continuously, they can actually cause worse congestion afterwards. So those are kind of the main categories of the products that work. And what's really interesting is although there are dozens and dozens of those traditional cold remedies on the shelf, almost all of them have about the same ingredients. So here's a little tip. So if you see if it says something, it'll have a letter D on it. So it'll say something, and it'll say dash D. That means it has a decongestant. Or if you see it has a dash DM, that has dextromethorphan, which is for cough. Or if you see an E, it has an expectorant. And usually those ingredients are all the same. So there's about 6 or 7 different companies that make cough remedies, and they all have basically the same ingredients. There's going to be differences in the flavor, but generally they're all pretty much the same.
But that's about it, just the flavor. Good.
So another product that's really interesting that I was surprised, actually does seem to work is something called a neti pot. Have you ever heard of a neti pot?
I have. I tried it once.
And?
It felt weird.
Weird. If you've ever been body surfing and you've been hit by a big wave, then that's kind of what a neti pot feels like. So that was my impression. I tried it, and then in the interest of science, I did give it a try. So neti pots are these little devices. They look like little tea kettles. You fill them with water and a bit of salt. You tilt your head. You jam the spout in one nostril, and you lean your head over until the water flows out the other nostril. So while it's not clear that neti pots make a whole lot of difference for colds, they do seem to work. They work okay, and there's good data to show that they seem to work for long-term sinus issues. So for people who say, I don't want any drugs at all, I don't want to take a decongestant, I just want something to clear up my nasal passages because I can't pass this mucus in my nose, then I say, well, you can try a neti pot. But they may sound like an alternative treatment, but they're not alternative because they work. So they're medicine now.
We have a question from the chat from Cy Curious.
How does a drug like Tylenol reduce cough? What's the mechanism?
Tylenol would be effective for reducing pain, but acetaminophen or Tylenol doesn't have the anti-inflammatory properties as the drugs like Advil and Motrin. So that will provide you with some pain relief, but it won't provide the cough suppressant effects that the anti-inflammatory drugs do. The anti-inflammatory drugs have effects on several other systems other than the Tylenol. So Tylenol is very good for pain relief, but doesn't have the other effects in terms of the other effects that you may see with the positive treatment of colds.
Well, you mentioned cough suppressants.
Yeah, so dextromethorphan, or DM, is what you see on the label of some products. And the benefits of DM, and this is a very popular ingredient in cough remedies, is actually not that impressive. So there's only been a few pretty poorly conducted trials, and they're not impressive. And that's the same with that expectorant guaifenesin, which it'll say DMD or DMDE on the labels. And the expectorant as well, there's really not good data to suggest that those products are particularly effective. So if you don't want to use DM, you'll sometimes see some cough products, and depending on the country you're in, or I think even by province, in Canada they're usually behind the counter, but you'd have to ask the pharmacist for them. But there's cough and cold products that contain codeine. And codeine's actually been evaluated in good detail, and it really doesn't seem to be that effective for acute cough. So it doesn't seem to have any real benefit for people who have cough due to colds.
Well, what about zinc for coughs? It's in so many lozenges now.
Yeah, zinc's been studied, and the effects are inconsistent. I'd say that it's probably a plausible treatment, Zinc can cause quite a bit of nausea. It's one product I tried myself several years ago, and I noticed it as well. It does cause nausea, and the lozenges don't have a great taste. So my concern with these studies is always whether they've been properly blinded. The blinding has been able to be maintained. So I think that the science isn't clear yet on that. I do want to point out that the FDA issued a public health advisory I think it was 2009 about zinc products because of the reports of permanent loss of smell. But that was with a topical spray. So I would say that while zinc has potential, I definitely wouldn't recommend it as a nasal spray. If you want to try it to duplicate the effects that were in place in the clinical trials, you need to take a lozenge every 2 or 3 hours while you're awake.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So you have to use it pretty frequently. The idea is basically you're kind of bathing the back of your throat with zinc. So, and as I said, a lot of people find that it makes them quite nauseous. So, but certainly, I mean, if you wanted to try the lozenges, that's something you could try. Most people find that they can't. They don't like them that much.
We have a question from the chat from Anxious Medic.
Should we control fever with a cold? I've heard that many infectious disease doctors are suggesting a fever should be left to run its course.
I don't think that there's good evidence to. I mean, you definitely don't have to control the fever if you don't want to. If you know, if it's for yourself or for a child, certainly, I mean, you can treat it if they're uncomfortable, and that's usually what I recommend. There's no mandatory need to treat a fever. Certainly, if the fever gets too high, then that becomes a medical issue. But we're just talking about, say, like a slight elevation in temperature. If it's not bothering you, or you don't, or your child's not complaining about fever, then you don't have to treat it. But if they're more comfortable and they're sleeping, and they you know, if they can't sleep, then I don't have any hesitation in recommending it. I don't think that we have really good evidence to say that there's you know, significant problems from treating a fever. And I think we have to weigh that against the fact that, you know, if you have a bad fever and you can't sleep, then there could be consequences to that as well if you're, you know, if it's disrupting you in other ways.
And a question from the chat, another one from PsyCurious. And for those who are jealous, she gets as many as she wants.
What kind of studies are currently ongoing with the common cold? Are they working on prevention, shortening of symptoms? What things are being tested right now, if any?
That's a good question. I could jump onto clinicaltrials.gov and look right now, but Desiree has forbidden me from touching my keyboard, so I can't do that. So I'm actually not sure. I mean, I think that, you know, there's a lot of products that have been evaluated. Certainly, there's some that continue to be studied in trials, and there's more research around. Some of them are promising products. What surprises me, a lot of these products that have been on the shelf for years, decades in some cases, there's no trials that I can see underway, and no trials have even been done. They've just been used because they've been used, and they're popular because they're popular. And once something's popular and being used, you know, what's the incentive for a manufacturer to do a trial?
And we'll get to more on the common cold with pharmacist Scott Guevara after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, researcher and blogger PsyCurious returns to examine the various recreational drugs that we use to alter consciousness. How do they affect us? How do we study them? And do they have any uses beyond their recreational properties? And we'll speak to pharmaceutical researcher David Kroll about cannabimimetics, synthetic compounds that mimic the effects of marijuana. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm talking with pharmacist Scott Guevara, who blogs about pharmacy practice and questionable science at Science-Based Pharmacy and Science-Based Medicine. So before the break, we sort of established that cold products may work kinda. So what can we do to avoid catching a cold in the first place? And for reference, we did ask the audience to tweet us all the products that they wanted to hear about, and there were a lot. So we'll try to get through as many as we can. Starting with the granddaddy, the one that everyone always wants to know about, echinacea.
So echinacea has been studied very extensively, and I think that the data is pretty clear now that it actually does not work for the prevention or treatment of the cold or the flu. And it's not one that I recommend at all anymore. I think that this was one that had seemed to go in kind of in like the mid-90s was very popular. But as more and more data emerges, it's more and more conclusive that that product really doesn't seem to do a whole lot. So, yeah, I don't recommend it. There's some pretty good write-ups on that on Science-Based Medicine, and I've done one on Science-Based Pharmacy as well. So for more detail on the kind of the trials that have been done, you can look at them. But, yeah, it's disappointing, but, no, it doesn't seem to work.
And it seems that everyone also wants to know about ColdFX. There were a lot of duplicates with the products that we got.
ColdFX is a ginseng product, and it's pretty popular in Canada, I think, because of the tie-in with, you know, Don Cherry and the hockey promotion. But it's a product that's been developed in Canada, and I think, I want to say to the company's credit, they've done trials with the product. And I think one of the challenges with herbal products is if you don't know what the active ingredient is, you don't have any way of controlling to ensure that your product is consistent from batch to batch.
Right.
And so what the manufacturer has done is they've believed that they've standardized what they believe are the active ingredients in that, and that's why their product, I would say, you know, really with any herbal product, it's very difficult to compare between brands because, you know, what part of the herb is actually in the product and when was it picked and harvested. And when you don't know what the active ingredient is, you don't have any way of actually comparing, you know, between products. So as I said, to the company's credit, they've standardized the product and they've done some research. But I think the unfortunate thing is the findings are really unimpressive. And to me, it's not clear that the effects really differ dramatically from placebo. So, you know, even if it is effective, the effect seems fairly small. It's not so clear that it's worth it. I calculated that you'd need to take it for kind of 4 years of cold seasons to prevent a single cold. There's really no great evidence to suggest it has any meaningful effects on a cold once you have one. So, as I said, I mean, I'd like to see some more studies with it, but based on what we've seen so far, it's really not that impressive.
It's expensive as well, isn't it?
It is pretty expensive, yeah. I think that I did do a calculation on the cost, and I think I calculated it would be a few hundred dollars to prevent a single cold based on the data that had been published.
I'm sure I'm going to get angry emails about that. How about vitamin C?
Vitamin C, well, at least it's not expensive. So vitamin C has been, you know, a favorite since the time of Linus Pauling. But the research has kind of shown otherwise. It's failed to find a consistent and convincing effect. And I think this is when you look at a lot of the natural products or even drug products, is not only do you want to see an effect, but you want to see it demonstrated consistently. And, you know, really, if you want to think about taking the product, you want it to be a convincing, like a meaningful effect. So with vitamin C, there's no great evidence to support kind of routine supplementation in the regular population. Now, there's some evidence to suggest that people who are in extreme cold conditions or extremely physical active, that there may be some benefit, but it's not clear that it's a real effect. Because they've done some studies in marathon runners, and it's suggested that the cold, there seems to be fewer colds in people who take vitamin C supplements. But there's also concerns about antioxidants like vitamin C blocking some of the beneficial effects of exercise. And I've blogged about that pretty recently on Science-Based Medicine. And I don't know if it's clear yet either. But, I mean, generally, I don't think there's enough to justify a specific supplement of vitamin C for the prevention of cold. But on the plus side, there's little evidence of actual harm for most people with kind of routine supplementation.
How about vitamin D?
Now, vitamin D is quite interesting, and I guess to answer Cycurious, I hope that there is more research going on with vitamin D, because I think that vitamin D is actually pretty interesting. There's an association, you know, between rickets, you know, the vitamin D deficiency and respiratory tract infections, and there's population-level studies that have associated, you know, vitamin D levels with recent respiratory tract infections. But trials that have randomized patients, you know, prospectively to vitamin D supplements or placebo, they haven't been as impressive in showing a benefit with respect to colds. So, you know, we could do a whole show on vitamin D on its own just to look at all the different trials and the evidence for and against vitamin D. But I would say when we're talking about specifically supplementing for colds, there's not great evidence to show that there's benefit, but there may be reasons to supplement unrelated to colds. I think that there's good evidence to suggest that it should be studied, but my kind of bottom line is I would say that the efficacy of vitamin D supplements for preventing colds hasn't been demonstrated yet.
And following the alphabet, vitamin E.
Vitamin E. I think vitamin E should probably not be taken by anyone for any reason, the supplements. I think that the risks for vitamin E are, you know, vitamin E is looking worse and worse in trials, and there really doesn't seem to be any great evidence of benefit with supplements. I've blogged about vitamin E as well. I think that the risks, you know, I don't recommend vitamin E supplements as a separate supplement for anyone anymore.
And why is that?
There's concerns about cancer risks with vitamin E in terms of increasing the risk of cancers. And I think that in the case of vitamin E, it's not really clear that the supplements are actually provide any. That's the interesting thing, is that it's never been shown that the drug actually provides a substantial benefit. And so when you're looking at a product that may or may not have harms, and the benefit really isn't clear or, you know, hasn't been demonstrated, then that kind of, when I'm making recommendations to people, really tilts the kind of the risk benefit very far away from that product. Because if there isn't clear benefit, then why would you take on any incremental risk with supplementing? And when you're talking about preventing something like colds, then you need to supplement, you know, routinely, because you don't know when you're going to get a cold. You can't just load up on it once you've got the cold. So, yeah, I don't recommend vitamin E supplements.
Now, the next one is one that honestly is thrust at me every time I get sick. Oil of oregano.
It works on your pizza. It works on your colds. I love that stuff. The oil of oregano is amazing because there's really no great data to suggest that it really does anything. Now, it kills viruses in a test tube, but, you know, if you throw lime and tequila and salt in a test tube, it'll kill your cold virus. It'll kill viruses too. But nobody's recommending margaritas to prevent colds. except maybe, you know, big tequila. But
big tequila, so yeah, say, that's a thing now.
They're
so
very
really,
low key.
No oil of oregano, not at all.
I
can tell all
I mean,
my
well,
coworkers.
I mean, there's no data that we can point to say that it has any meaningful effect. I mean, if you look at what the claims are about oil of oregano, it basically does everything.
All right, how about something else yummy? Garlic.
You know, it's a standby for preventing colds. And it could have antiviral properties, again, but it's not clear that when you're actually consuming it, it has those same properties when you're absorbing the chemical constituents of garlic. There's some pretty weak evidence to suggest that a garlic supplement might reduce the chance that you get colds. So it's promising. I'd like to see better evidence before I recommend supplementing it. You know, but I love garlic. And if my souvlaki will reduce my chance of getting a cold, I'm all for it. But I want more evidence before I say you should be taking a garlic supplement. Maybe a souvlaki supplement I might feel different about. But garlic supplements, not yet.
I can get behind that, actually. How about ginger?
Ginger, again, I think that, you know, subjectively you can drink ginger and you feel better. I know when I was sick, my parents always gave me flat ginger ale and I felt, you know, amazed by that because of the sugar and the ginger. But there's no data to suggest that ginger has any meaningful effects on preventing a cold. And there's no clear mechanism to say that it would have an effect.
And when we're talking about these kinds of remedies, what kinds of studies are we talking about? Like, how many studies have been done on things like this?
It's a kind of the same trajectory we see with a lot of supplements in that, you know, there may be one clinical trial that shows an effect, but it's small and preliminary. Then you see more studies and the data is, you know, they're better controlled, they're larger, and the effect seems smaller until you do even better studies, and then the effect gets even smaller still. So you see this kind of trajectory of early studies showing promise, and then the large studies show that it becomes dead negative. And we see it again and again with a lot of different products. You know, it's another one with elderberry, which was another one that was on the list, was, you know, there's some preliminary data to show that elderberry extracts might reduce flu-like symptoms. So I guess that's actually more of a treatment more than a preventative. And there's one, you know, study showing some effect, but it's small and preliminary. So I think that it's really hard to conclude from a single study whether it's promising or not.
We have a question from Jamie.
My mother swears by astragalus. Is there any science behind it?
It's a Chinese herb. It's promoted to prevent colds and the flu, but I couldn't find any data to show that it's effective for actually preventing infections.
What about homeopathy? Because a number of listeners asked about a product called, help me out here, Scott. Starts with an O.
I think it's Acyliococconium.
I'm going to go with you.
Is that the
one? Yeah, sure. Sounds good.
Yeah, again, very, very popular product for treating and preventing colds and the flu. So it's Acyliococconium is a homeopathic dilution of duck liver and heart extract. And I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar with it. But if you're not, homeopathy is a treatment system invented in the 1800s by a German physician named Samuel Hahnemann. The key principles of homeopathy are, the first one is like treats like. And the second one is potentiation through dilution. So what that means is you would treat an illness with something that causes the same symptoms, but you would dilute it a lot. Now, Acyliococconium is absurd even by homeopathic standards. So in the early 1900s, a French physician decided that Acyliococci, which was something that he invented, the name he invented, were the one true cause of disease. So he saw these, he called them Acyliococci when he was looking, I think, under a microscope. But he probably just saw some bubbles under a microscope because Acyliococci don't exist. But he decided the best source of Acyliococci were a duck's heart and liver. So, you know, a single duck is used to make the world's supply of Acyliococconium. So it's made by, you take this duck, Barbary duck, which is a very unattractive looking duck. You take some of its liver and its heart and you mush it up and you let it ferment for 40 days. And then you dilute it. So you take one part in 100, so take a drop or 1 mL out of 100 mils and you dilute it 200 times in a row, and then you take that final dilution and you drip it on tablets of lactose and sugar. Now that's pretty dilute. So in order to get even a single molecule of that original fermented duck, you'd need to consume a volume of tablets greater than the mass of the entire universe. So how's that for dilute? Not surprisingly, there's no proof that it has any effects on colds and the flu. There have been a couple of trial duns, but the effects aren't meaningful. And there's been a Cochrane review that kind of concluded it was effective based on this weak data. And that Cochrane review has been withdrawn from what I can see. Now, in the United States, I'm aware of at least one class action lawsuit against the manufacturer, basically saying, you know, you're selling a product with no active ingredients. So, no, unfortunately, there's no great evidence to support the use of homeopathy, and particularly this product, for colds or the flu.
Well, and this is really one of the problems with homeopathy, in my opinion, is that people confuse homeopathy with herbal remedies.
Yes, and I think that once you explain kind of the principles of homeopathy and you clarify that in the vast majority of homeopathic products, there's no actual active ingredients, they realize that, you know, that's they realize the difference. And, you know, for me as a pharmacist interested in science, herbal products are actually really quite interesting because nature is an amazing chemical generating factory. And there's all these really interesting compounds that have been isolated in from natural sources and refined and developed into drugs. So, the homeopathic treatment scheme is really not all that interesting because all the remedies are essentially indistinguishable because none of them contain actual active ingredients. So I guess that's interesting from kind of a perspective about why people would use these products or why people would attribute positive effects to them. But there's no chemical effects because there's no active ingredient.
So it's not enough to just say, hey, look, there's no active ingredient in that thing that you like to use. People still want to keep using them. Why do you think that is?
Well, like I said, I mean, I think that with colds, it's very difficult to say. I mean, I thought I was getting a cold last night because I'd been reading up on colds and I thought, oh, I'm getting sick, which is, but I took my imaginary homeopathy and I feel better today. So I think that, because I don't have a cold. So I think that's just it. It's like we get a lot of colds, kids get six to 10 or more colds a year. Adults get, several per year. And when the elderly actually get fewer colds. We all get colds and they're all different. We don't know when a cold starts, how long it's going to last, or if it's going to manifest itself into a bad cold. So if you take a cold remedy of, whether it's alternative or not, and your symptoms go away, you might say, oh, it's great. Look at this product is working. My imaginary homeopathy worked or my cough syrup worked or whatever else. But you don't actually know the natural history of the cold itself. And that's why we, in these types of infections, having actual controlled trials is really important because we have no idea whether the products actually are doing anything or not unless we're actually controlling for, using a placebo and actually putting people in trials because we have no idea how long the cold's going to last.
We have a question from Gravespinner.
Why are so many ineffective products available in Canada? Is the Natural Health Products Directorate not supposed to confirm efficacy?
The Natural Health Products Directorate's standard for efficacy is actually pretty low. I mean, homeopathic products are approved by the Natural Health Products Directorate, and those products are also considered to be safe and effective. So the standard for evidence for natural health products is so low that effectively anecdotal evidence can qualify as evidence of efficacy. And so the bar is quite low for those products, as well with a number of the so-called, I guess we can call them conventional products or other products. They have a long history of use, and they've been on the market for a long time. But there's really not when you look at the evidence, as I was talking about with dextromethorphan or guaifenesin or these other ingredients, the data are really not that impressive. And that's one of the reasons why the cough and cold products for children were, they were withdrawn or their products were relabeled so that they've been told not to use them in children. And this is because with kids, there's evidence of, toxicity, and there's been evidence of adverse events with kids using these cough and cold products, and there's no actual evidence to show that they actually do anything. So again, just like other products with vitamins and things, if there's no evidence of benefit that's been demonstrated and there are risks associated with the treatment, it tilts that risk benefit far away from, supporting its use. And that's why in Canada and worldwide, we've seen the cough and cold products for children being relabeled not to be used in children for exactly that reason. But, as I've pointed out, I don't think the data is really that much better in adults either.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and pharmacist Scott Guevara is discussing how to treat the common cold. So let's talk a bit about our grandparents' wisdom. How does that stack up? Does chicken soup really help with the cold?
Well, again, there's no good evidence to show it's of benefit, but how do you do a placebo-controlled trial with soup? This placebo soup tastes an awful lot like chicken soup. So I don't know how you're going to do a controlled trial with that. Are you going to pump it into the stomach through the nose or something? I don't know how you could do a controlled trial. If you find it comforting, that's great. Maybe it's our bodies just craving a lot of salt.
How about feed a fever, starve a cold? I've heard that all my life.
Yeah, I don't think that there's evidence to suggest that you need to starve your cold. I mean, I think if you're hungry, eat. If you're not, you don't have to eat. But I don't think there's no good evidence to suggest that you actually need to do that as a rule.
Where would that have come from? Any idea?
No, that one I don't know. I don't think it's really clear why that's come out. It may be around some of these different ideas that we had around colds. And I think that actually reminds me of one of the products that I saw on the list that I want to talk about, because I thought it was really pretty fascinating, was this, someone had suggested that they had, or mentioned that they had been a folk remedy, I guess, mustard plasters. A commenter mentioned that on Facebook. Have you heard of those before?
I hadn't, and I had to look them up.
And what did you find out about them?
Well, it sounds maybe not as effective as it could be.
So, yeah, mustard plasters are kind of, you know, this very old vintage product, I guess, but it's a topical product, and it uses mustard seeds. And mustard contains chemicals called isothiocyanates, and if you crush the seeds with water, it produces a substance that you kind of spread out on a cheesecloth or on a tea towel, and you apply it to the skin, and it heats the skin. It causes kind of an irritation. If you leave it too long on the skin, it can cause blistering and even ulcers. So, you know, if you look online, you can see these recipes for mustard plasters that are still online, and I think that they may have actually been commercially prepared before. There's still a lot of support for them from alternative therapy providers.
Absolutely. And this is not something that is historical, I wanted to point out.
No. Well, I mean, there's still recommendations for use, and I found recipes online. I think that they've kind of been gradually discarded from in general science-based practice, and I don't see them for sale anymore. But they do live on. But I think that this has kind of evolved out of this idea of what are called counter-irritants. And they're still called that. And you know, the idea was that you could cure internal problems by creating an external irritation on your skin. So you would draw blood to the surface of the skin and you would suck the toxins out. So this all ties into the whole, you know, the foot pads or the foot detox. It's the same kind of idea where you've got these counter irritants that, you know, the blood, you know, irritating the skin, and skin by doing that, you're helping treat the actual cold. And, you know, I'd say that there may be a role for counter irritants. So, you know, there's products can produce warming on the outer surface of the skin for people who have, you know, pain in their joints, and they use those products. They may actually provide some subjective relief. So I would say that those are probably reasonable. But when you're talking about using a counter irritant for a cold, it's really not clear that that's going to have any effect unless you kind of subjectively feel better. And, you know, kind of on that same line, you could look at Vicks VapoRub, which is, you know, not that dissimilar, because Vicks VapoRub's been around since the 1800s, and VapoRub contains menthol and eucalyptus oil, and, you know, it's popular, but there's little research to suggest that it actually relieves cough symptoms and congestions, but it might make you feel comfortable, and maybe your parents used it when you were a kid like mine did, and you take a whiff of it and you flash back to, you know, your Empire Strikes Back sheets and your hot humidifier and the that shoots steam into your room, and maybe it makes you feel better. So, you know, but I don't think that there's really any good evidence to suggest that it works. And this is actually really pretty disappointing to me, because you'd think that if these products had been on the sale for 100 years, they could have done at least one or two clinical trials. But there aren't. Not that I can see. I can't find any trials with something like Vicks VapoRub to actually show that it has a meaningful effect.
Well, you mentioned humidifiers. I was wondering about those.
So, yeah, humidifiers are interesting as well. And, I mean, the thought, I guess, has been is that the dry air could dry out your nasal passages. And I guess plausibly, I would say if your nasal passages are really dry, you might increase the risk of infection. And that would be kind of somewhat consistent with the seasonal pattern where we see kind of colds more in the winter months. But as I said, for people who get deliberately infected, it's when they squirt the virus into your nostrils. You know, almost 100% get sick. So it probably has very little to do with humidity itself. So my suggestion is, you know, if you feel better, you know, and the humidity makes you feel a little bit better, then that's fine. But I wouldn't expect it to actually alter the frequency, severity, or duration of a cold.
How about the idea that you shouldn't drink milk when you're sick because it will increase the phlegm? And I'd like to point out that phlegm is just a nasty word. There's no way to say that nicely.
No, but it sounds exactly like it is, right?
This is like, it's like onomatopoeia. Nice.
That's exactly right. It. I don't think there's any good evidence to suggest that drinking milk increases the amount of mucus you produce. And, you know, while milk may look like mucus, milk is like fat and protein emulsified in water. And the protein in milk is kind of broken down like the other amino acids that you're eating. So, you know, there's actually been a study that looked at this, and those that drink milk didn't have any more mucus than non-drinkers. So if you're feeling ill and you want to drink milk, go for it.
Here's a question by email from Christy.
What about colloidal silver? My sister believes it kills bacteria and viruses.
I think that there's some serious health issues related to the consumption of colloidal silver. And if you search online, I think it's been documented in Science-Based Medicine, some of the effects of that. You can see people who have changed color because of taking colloidal silver.
Really?
Of deposits. Yeah. So, no, this is another instance where there's been this extrapolation of kind of the use of silver in, you know, topical situations. So like you can have topical dressings and creams that contain silver products that are antibacterial, but that doesn't mean when you actually consume silver, it's going to have the same effect. So it's not that dissimilar, I would say, from the oil of oregano, where you there's often what you see is an extrapolation of what's occurring in a test tube into what's occurring in the body. And you really can't make that extrapolation without having evidence to demonstrate that all the different pieces connect up between how you consume it, whether it's absorbed, where does it actually go when it's in the body, how is it metabolized, does it actually reach the site of action at the right concentration to actually have an effect, how is it eliminated. All those things are things that you think about with drugs, and you need to think about them when you see, well, such and such cures something in the test tube.
Now, when I asked people about their favorite cold remedies on Twitter, I noticed that a disproportionate amount appeared to be alcohol-based. So does booze work?
Oh, I wish it did, Desiree.
Oh, but, you are a downer, sir.
Well, let me give you the good news. If you're a wine drinker, I'd say it's encouraging. So there's population research to suggest that, you know, light to moderate consumption of wine, particularly red wine, is associated with fewer colds.
Amen.
But I don't think that there's good evidence to show that consuming wine will actually reduce the number of colds that you get. So I think it's difficult, as with a lot of these epidemiologic studies, you need to tease out whether there is an actual Is it a causative effect? Is it a causal relationship? I don't think that's been demonstrated. I guess we can say that, you know, short-term ingestion of moderate amounts of red wine, you know, don't seem to have any effects on immune function. So I would say there's no reason to change your current practices. If you drink wine, that's fine. I mean, I have to say drinking alcohol is not something that I really want to do when I'm sick, although I've heard people tell me that they like to drink a whole lot of scotch, cover themselves with a lot of blankets, and then try to sleep it off. Not something I would recommend.
Because there were literally very explicit recipes for what that I received, which were lovely. But then there was rum, and there was vodka, and tequila, I believe, was in somebody's. So no, none of those, hey?
Again, I think this ties into, like, as we've been talking about, is really how long is your cold going to last? You don't know when you start. So as I said last night when I thought I was going to have a cold, I could have, you know, taken out the old spiced rum, had, you know, quite a bit of that, and I would have felt better today. I would have been a little groggy, but my cold wouldn't have been here. And I may have been shilling big rum on the call tonight for that reason. But if you're drinking enough alcohol to actually kill the viruses, you're probably already dead. It's going to kill a lot more than just the viruses.
Noted. And now, is there something about lemon? Because Mila and Annabelle mentioned warm lemon juice and honey. Kylie said flat lemonade. And Liz sips hot lemonade made with spicy chili and ginger.
Yeah, I don't know if there's anything specific about lemon that I would say. I think that a lot of it is subjective. I mean, I think, you know, people feel better. They think they're getting some vitamin C. I think a lot of the hot beverages might help you breathe better just because you're drinking a hot beverage, you're inhaling the vapor. It's you make you subjectively feel better. You might be, you know, anything that's got spice in it that's got spice added might cause increasing mucus production, make it easier for you to blow your nose. So I don't think that we can say that there's necessarily a causal effect. Some of it might be symptomatic in terms of just making you feel better. You know, there could be some effects. I don't think there's any way we could say that there's scientific evidence to support the use of lemon, though.
How about honey? Honey was also mentioned quite a few times in the
Twitter
stream.
Yeah, so honey is an interesting one, too, because this is one of the things that came up, I think, certainly around the time when the cough products were being withdrawn for kids. Now, there's a study that I saw that compared buckwheat honey before bedtime with that of either nothing or DM, the dextromethorphan, that's found in many of the over-the-counter cough products. And parents of the pill children who received honey, they reported, you know, more improvement than those who received the DM, but there wasn't a difference between the DM and the honey. The honey group reported more negative side effects, but that wasn't statistically significant either. But there was a significant difference between honey and no treatment at all. But my take is, well, if DM doesn't really work, there's no evidence to show DM works, and honey is as good as DM, that I don't really know what you can conclude about honey. I think the other important point that I want to emphasize is that you should never give honey to children under the age of a year because of a small but a very real risk of botulism spores in honey, which are, again, very, very rare, but still I would never recommend. It's important not to give honey to children under the age of 1 year.
Well, on that kind of topic, we have a question from Anxious Medic.
What is gripe water, and should it be given to kids for colds?
So gripe water is another interesting product that has a long history of use without a lot of good evidence to suggest that it actually has a lot of effect. I've written about grape water specifically for colic, and I've done that on science-based medicine and on my blog, and there isn't really good evidence to show that grape water works. It's also somewhat difficult to say because there's a number of different formulas for grape water now. A lot of them used to contain alcohol. Now they don't. And as I said, they're really used more for colic than for anything else. We're really challenged by having a lack of good information to suggest that it works. So I haven't looked at colic or grape water for colds, but I suspect that it's probably has not been studied.
All right. Let's see if we can fit in a few more audience questions. From Dan, fresh fruit always works.
I think fresh fruit is great. I mean, I think that there's a lot of benefits for consuming lots of fresh fruit all the time. And, you know, most people feel better when they eat an orange. You're getting, you know, you're getting your vitamin C, you're getting some fiber, you're getting some fluid. So instead of taking your vitamin C supplements, just try to boost your fresh fruit intake because you're going to get the vitamin C and you're going to get all these other beneficial aspects of the fruit. You're also getting your fiber and you're getting some liquid too. So I think that if possible, I would always recommend that you try to get, you know, maximize your vitamin intake through your foods rather than taking a specific supplement.
And we have a question from the chat from Loxloy.
Many high-performance athletes take many supplements, including various amino acids. Do these help prevent colds, as some hope?
Not that I'm aware of. Keep in mind that amino acids are just kind of the breakdown product of protein. And I generally recommend, I think it's difficult to say. I think that we're challenged by a lack of evidence. There's a lot of superstitions and other things that can go into the supplementing use that's by athletes. I would suggest whether if you're you know a weekend warrior or you know an everyday athlete is to maximize the your consumption of whole foods and unrefined foods in a way and to try to get your protein from those sources and not worry specifically about taking any particular amino acids.
Okay, so this next one actually wins the prize for weirdest home remedy I have ever heard. A chief medical resident said, a friend's mom put a lit cigarette in her ear, lit end out, when she had a sore throat or earache.
I think this is kind of along the lines of ear candling. I mean, maybe it, I don't know, maybe it sucks the toxins out. I don't know.
Is that where that idea would come from?
I'd be curious to know where the origins of where that came from, because I can't think about anything why that would even be thought to be an effective rationale for using for treating a cold, although I can't understand why people would use ear candles either. So I my sense is it's kind of coming along those same lines of, you know, sucking out the toxins or something. But no, I got nothing.
How about, and this is a tweet from Nicole, how about the copious use of NyQuil and just sleeping through the entire cold?
I mean, NyQuil is just another cold remedy, although some of the formulations will contain alcohol, though I'm not sure if all of them do. A lot of the cold remedies used to be alcohol-based and would have alcohol in them. A lot of them have now eliminated or really reduced the amount of alcohol. So I know people swear by certain brands, but as I said, the ingredients that I've talked about are the ones that are in those products, and it's really quite interesting that you'll see somebody swear by, you know, the Benlin or the Triaminic or the, you know, whatever brands that they have when it's the same active ingredients. So, I mean, I think that a lot of times, you know, sleeping it off may be helpful. And, you know, as I said, there may be antihistamines in your cold remedy, whether it's NyQuil or whatever, that will actually cause drowsiness and actually may help you sleep better. But I don't think there's anything specific in the ingredients that is actually reducing the duration or the severity of the cold itself.
Okay, last audience question, and I find this very interesting. It's from Evil Eye Monster.
Why is the rhinovirus called a cold? Isn't cold bad for viruses?
I don't think it's really clear. I think that it came out of the idea that we were getting sick at the time that it was, we were, you know, when the weather is colder. Colds seem to be spread more during the colder seasons. We're indoors more. That's the only reason I can find for why it's actually called the cold. I don't think that we really know the kind of the history of that, but that's my sense is probably that association with kind of cold seasonal weather.
Now we're getting near the end of the interview, and you are not on call for all our listeners on a regular basis. So what would you suggest is the best way for people to research these kinds of things themselves so they don't spend a bunch of money on products that don't work?
So I'm a big fan of custom Google searches. So what those are people who have curated a Google search to search only specific sites. And I'm going to recommend two, and I'll send you the link so you can post them. So the first one, Tim Farley of What's the Harm, has created an excellent search engine that searches only skeptical sites. And it's a great way to quickly sort out whether something's been kind of critically appraised or debunked. So I use his search engine quite regularly if I'm looking for a quick way of sorting out, you know, the reviews from the sales pitches. There's a second one that I use, which is a similar kind of Google search engine called Netting the Evidence, and I like to use it to get a quick overview of what's in the literature. It searches databases like the Cochrane database that conducts systematic reviews. So both of those are kind of good for kind of the quick and dirty searches. Finally, what a lot of people may be familiar with, PubMed, which searches the National Library of Medicine, or Medline. They also operate an excellent site for non-health professionals, non-specialists, called Medline Plus, that contains kind of excellent science-based medical information written in kind of general language. There's two databases that I use that are both subscription, unfortunately. The first one is called Natural Medicine's Comprehensive Database, which is an excellent site, which basically is my first go-to site for looking up any type of supplement, because they kind of curate and review all the trials out there. And so it's a great starting point for getting a sense of the overview of the literature. So I use that regularly. And then there's a second one called UpToDate, which is also for medical professionals, which is also a subscription-only site, but also is a very good review site as well that I use for kind of the starting of the search before I go into the actual literature itself. So all of those are good, but as I said, the Google searches are good. Or sometimes you can, if I'm doing a Google search, I'll put in -.com. So I'll put in a dash and then put .com, so it'll strip out all the .com sites, so all the sites that are typically selling a particular product.
Ah.
And hopefully you can search the, you know, the EDUs and the .orgs, which doesn't filter it out completely, because I think that's the challenge that we have is when you're trying to search, you want to search credible sites, and you don't want to search sites that are selling the product.
Exactly.
And that can be difficult to do.
Lovely. Thanks, sir. And as always, it is an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, it's been great being here. I'm looking forward to being back next week so I can ask Cycurious some really tough questions.
You can find links to pharmacist Scott Guevara of Science-Based Medicine and Science-Based Pharmacy on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You'll also see links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. And now, a holiday message from Skeptically Speaking. If you're the person who has everything, or you're trying to find a gift for one of those people, we'd like to offer you an assortment of science-related charities that will happily take your money. They're all registered charities in their countries, or projects of organizations that are, and they're all providing education, science promotion, or other valuable services. We haven't exhaustively researched them, so do check them out before donating. You can find links to all of the organizations that we'll mention on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. Now, if you'd like to help promote science awareness and understanding, you can give to the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS is an international non-profit organization dedicated to advancing science around the world. They work to foster education and increase public engagement in science and technology for everyone, and to strengthen and diversify the science and technology workforce. The National Center for Science Education is a not-for-profit membership organization that provides information and resources for schools, parents, and concerned citizens working to keep evolution in public school science education. And their executive director, Eugenie Scott, is amazing. In the UK, there's Sense About Science, which works in partnership with scientific bodies, research publishers, policymakers, the public, and the media to change public discussions about science. Their award-winning public campaigns share the tools of scientific thinking and scrutiny, and their International Voice of Young Science Network engages hundreds of early career researchers in public debates about research and evidence. The Royal Institution of Australia is a national scientific non-profit organization with a mission to bring science to people and people to science. Their vision is that science should become recognized as pivotal in everyday life. They aim to broaden the appreciation of science and technology as a part of the culture of Australia and to help develop inquiring minds that can appreciate the process, constraints, and potential of science. And we were a bit sad to note that Canada doesn't seem to have an organization like this. Ahem. Helping to encourage interest and expand opportunities for women in science is an issue that's very close to our show's collective heart. three charities that promote and encourage women and girls in science, engineering, and technology are the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology, and in the U.S., the Association for Women in Science, and the Anita Borg Institute for Women and Technology. And the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology has a program that specifically helps immigrant women connect with mentors in their field, so do keep that in mind. And lots of fantastic charities out there are bringing the wonder of science to children. In Canada, we have Let's Talk Science, an award-winning national organization. They deliver science learning programs and services that turn children and youth onto science and keep them engaged in lifelong learning. In Ontario, and now in Lethbridge, Scientists in School is dedicated to encouraging a lasting interest in science, technology, math, environmental stewardship, and engineering. And ACTUA is a national organization that provides young Canadians with positive, interactive learning experiences in science and tech. Primary Connections is a project of the Australian Academy of Science that links science with literacy and aims to enhance primary school teachers' confidence and competence for teaching science. And we've talked about Dark Skies, Bright Kids on the show before. It's a project out of the astronomy department at the University of Virginia that brings astronomy to elementary students in rural Virginia. They foster the natural curiosity of children by helping them to explore the universe in a social setting with fun hands-on activities. Some other science-based or maybe just slightly nerdy charities that we wanted to mention include HealthRight International. HealthRight treats access to quality healthcare as a basic human right and works to build lasting access to health for excluded communities. Now, they've been on the show before to talk about how they help refugees provide evidence that they were tortured in their home countries. And Engineers Without Borders is an international coalition of dozens of national member groups that make use of their diverse technical expertise to solve critical problems affecting the health of our planet. The Canadian Air and Space Museum is a nonprofit organization that proudly showcases Canada's rich aviation history. Unfortunately, they're fighting eviction from their historic Toronto building, and they may be forced to close permanently, so they urgently need your help. And speaking of fighting, Open Media is a Canadian nonprofit that safeguards the possibilities of the open and affordable internet through citizens' campaigns like Stop the Meter. It was the largest online campaign in Canadian history, and it stopped mandatory usage-based billing being imposed on every Canadian. So it should go without saying that I think they're wonderful. And in the U.S., the Able Gamers Foundation promotes open dialogue, education, and research with the goal of bringing greater accessibility in the digital entertainment space. They help people with disabilities to gain a greater quality of life and develop the rich social life that gaming can bring. You all know what I'm talking about. One area of science that we think bears extra mention is stem cell research. Controversies over its practice and outright bans on funding by some governments leave this field of research chronically underfunded. You can consider donating to the Canadian Stem Cell Foundation, the UK Stem Cell Foundation, the Australian Stem Cell Centre, or the Bedford Stem Cell Research Foundation in the US. And finally, if you'd like to direct your holiday giving to places that promote critical thinking and reason-based values, we have got that covered too. The Skeptic Society is a scientific and educational organization of leading scientists, scholars, investigative journalists, historians, professors, and teachers. Their mission is to investigate and provide a sound scientific viewpoint on claims of the paranormal and pseudoscience, and they also publish Skeptic Magazine. The James Randi Educational Foundation, whose mission is to promote critical thinking by reaching out to the public and media with reliable information about the paranormal and supernatural ideas that are so widespread in our society today. They offer educational programs, workshops, and scholarships that encourage scientific skepticism. The Center for Inquiry Transnational works around the world to foster a secular society based on science, reason, freedom of inquiry, and humanist values. And they carry that work out through education, publishing, advocacy, and social services. And Foundation Beyond Belief is a U.S.-based charitable foundation created to focus, encourage, and demonstrate humanist generosity and compassion. They select and feature 10 charitable organizations per quarter with the goal of challenging humanists to embody the highest principles of humanism, including mutual care and responsibility. You can find out how to donate to any of the charities that we mentioned by visiting our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And if we missed your favorite science charity, do send us an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com, and we'll post it on the site with the rest of the links. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.